welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. And Merry Christmas to everybody. Again, we've got warm weather here in Illinois and all across this country. Incredible for a December 23rd as we pre-record this stuff. We're in the 60 degrees and it's raining. Well, we've got Bob Kohler back on our show again. Bob is the author of Courage Grows at the Wound. And, again, dealing with PTSD and everything. And Bob's a syndicated columnist, writes all over the place, a lot out of the Chicago Tribune content agency and Chicago Tribune Network. Bob, welcome to Warrior Connection again.
Well, thank you, Doug. Good to be back.
Hey, Ray, welcome back again.
Thank you, Doug. It's an honor to be with you.
Yeah. Well, what we're going to talk about now is a little bit about peace and everything. Bob has got a brand new column that's going to be coming out tomorrow, and we're going to talk about it a little today. I mean, he'll release it. It won't come out until the radio show will be on Sunday night. And I'm going to read this because it's very interesting, and then we'll go from there. Love South of Heaven by Robert Kohler. Right above love, as in love thy enemy, and the social recoil sounds like this. There's no nexus in which we can speak with ISIS, singing kumbaya while being led to a beheading. Can't work. Or this. Any thug who threatens a cop gets what he deserves. One bullet or ten, I could care less. If a thug will threaten a cop or a prison guard, he will kill or maim me or mine without hesitation for very little reason. Want to give these thugs civil rights? I want to give them a funeral. My way ensures me and mine do not get killed or maimed. Your way ensures I probably will. Now, as Bob writes, these are responses to recent columns he wrote in which he's tried to address the American and global hell created by the belief that violence rather endlessly beginning itself and spewing consequences far beyond conventional perception actually solves problems in something other than the shortest of short terms. This is tricky. Love thy enemy or words to that effect may be the foundation of Christianity and every other religion, but they're utterly misunderstood and belittled in the realm of popular culture, and I doubt they've ever been seriously taken at the level of government. If what they do in heaven, sing kumbaya, pray the harp, or love the other dead people, who of course went through a vetting process and to get in similar to what we now impose on refugees from Syria or Iraq, here on earth, come on, get real. The cynics cry, Trump, 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 because he tells it like it is. The way a junior high bully would. It's simple. It's linear. A bullet for a thug and the thug is dead. Problem solved. Of course, a bigger problem is also created, but to relate to this problem, ISIS, for instance, to one's own actions or action to one's country is way too complicated. So the cynics choose to stay simple. How do we counter the simplistic mindedness? The usual way to generate forces create anger, desire, and fear, writes Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist monk, teacher, peace activist. But these are dangerous sources of energy because they're blind. Let's pause mid-quote and summon the memory of our own impulsive emotions for our own anger and fear and blindness. Now let's arm these emotions. Whether or not we're justified in what we do next, a person on the receiving end is certain to have lost his or her humanity, at least for a terrible instant. Well, what could happen next so much worse when these emotions become collective? The result is a mob mentality. And when they become institutionalized, buried deep in the nation's soul, the inevitable result is war and war and war. And it's self-perpetuating. The humanized enemy strikes back, perhaps with horrendous actions, which, of course, justify what we do next. Eventually, one side or the other wins and peace prevails for a moment or two, but it's always a broken and temporary thing requiring armed guards at the perimeter. This is a peace with fear. And it's a way of life. Humanity's normal being perpetually armed, perpetually terrified, perpetually blind. But Hahn's quote continues, whereas the force of love springs from awareness and does not destroy its own aims, our love and willingness to act, strategies and tactics will be created naturally to the circumstances of the struggle. The force of love springs from awareness. What, oh God, does this mean? What especially does it mean beyond personal acts of big-hearted decency? Is love always distorted, often beyond recognition when it's institutionalized? Consider, for an instance, the idea of penitentiary, with the roots in the word penitent. It was conceived by early 19th century prison reformers to be a place of resurrection, spiritual rebirth for wayward souls. Maybe there was always a moralistic lunacy attached to the concept. In any case, it's no accident the concept degraded over the decades with the word pen and incarcerated have pretty much lost all their humanity. Prison must be something they fear, not just a momentary way station on the road to the next crime. My correspondent, quoted above, a prison former prison guard, I think, wrote in his reply to my column from last week, in which I discuss inmates beating death by guards. Today's prisons are a joke. The guards live in fear of the inmates, not the other way around. Beatings are all that will keep some inmates in line. Whoever said there is no such thing as a bad boy is a lunatic. They're bad boys, and more than you want to contemplate, and all they understood is superior violence. I quote him in order to let his words percolate next to those of Nhat Quynh Thanh. The force of love springs from awareness. Again, I ask, what does this mean? What does it mean in a world where violence is the answer to so many of our problems and a large percentage of our population is angry, fearful, and armed? What does it mean in a warm, prison-dependent economy stoked by too often clueless media with financial sake and more of the same? What does it mean in a world where cynicism rules? I reach out to the planet's peacemakers. I know there are millions of you enduring hardship and risking your lives to free us, to free the planet from our self-inflicted hell. The careless habits of mind and heart that allow us to pollute and waste also allow us to treat other human beings as disposable. That is a Conway wrote last June, commenting on a papal encyclical, Laudato Si, a true ecological approach. Pope Francis writes, always becomes a social approach. It must integrate questions of justice and debates on the environment so as to hear both the cry of the earth and the cry of the poor. I would add the cry of the refugees, the cry of the warriors, the cry of the inmates, the cry of the police, the cry of the prison guards, the cry of all humanity. Let us listen, let us reach out, let us look for one another in the eyes, no matter how difficult this proves to be. Bob, you never seem to amaze me.
Well, I that's what I try to do. Doug, you are one of my favorite people to write toward, because you speak the truth every time we, you know, you agree with me or you disagree with me, and you always tell me how you feel. And it's great to have you, you know, as somebody that I write to.
I mean, you and I have had some interesting times together. We both went through the concealed carry class together.
Absolutely.
So we learned from the best of the best, as you commented. I mean, when you were learning, you had a Cook County deputy sheriff and an FBI agent teaching you, and it was kind of like, this is really weird.
Yes, it is really weird. But it's because I want to be open to everything. I'm very, you know, I have a very strong viewpoint on certain issues, but I try to be open, you know, in every way I can. It's kind of nuts sometimes.
I really enjoyed,
you know, that the weekend with you, the gun weekend, as I call it.
You know, you yourself have, just like everybody in the military, gone through a private hell where the PTSD effects and your whole life has turned into turmoil, where you had to rearrange your whole life when your wife died at such a young age.
So you've been
writing about veterans and veterans' problems for years, haven't you?
Absolutely. Veterans, yes, are people that I care deeply about. And I mean, I've reached out. You are the person who initially made me become aware of, depleted uranium. And so I've written about that and the horrible consequences both on American soldiers that were exposed and the residents of the countries where we used it at in our weapons. And as well as PTSD and all the other kinds of toxic horrors that soldiers have gone through. I mean, PTSD is one of those, when I talk about in the column, the consequences, you know, that transcend, spewing consequences far, far beyond conventional perception. PTSD is certainly one of those sorts of consequences. But anyway, I've definitely been writing about vets and and want to stay close to everything that, you know, vets groups, especially Vets for Peace, are up to.
I mean, as you grew yourself, Ray
yes.
has been the strongest advocate of going on with your life, choosing who you hang around with and everything. I mean, Bob, you had to make that choice yourself to go on with
yes.
your life and raise your daughter after your wife died at such a young age.
Yes. Life goes on no matter what. No matter what one has been through personally, life goes on in so many ordinary ways where you have to pay the bills, you have to do this and that, but you also have to move forward in a way that I think makes you bigger than you were. The book that came out a few years ago, it's called Courage Grows Strong at the Wound. We all have a wound. We all have, you know, lots of wounds. And the wisdom, this is not, I didn't invent this phrase, it's a Scottish piece of wisdom that, you know, where one is wounded, that's where you grow strong, that's where you grow, you know, courage, and I would add wisdom as well, at these wounds. You know, when my wife died, I had to become a bigger person than I was before that had happened. It just, you know, life gives us lots of things like this, and, you know, we can, you know, at one point it'll defeat us, but, you know, but maybe not. Maybe we can keep rising up and learning and growing and changing the world for the better because of what we've been through.
Ray, this is exactly where you're coming from, isn't it?
Yeah. Doug, I was at Camp Lejeune today speaking to a fairly large group of Marines and sailors coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they've all been changed by their choices to go into military, one thing, and then choices they, most of them wanted to go to Afghanistan or Iraq or be, you know, participate. But when they come back, they see differently, like in black and white, and they have to relearn how to adapt, improvise, and overcome, and that's what I was there to try to teach them, those things. And what I have learned from my own self, and, you know, I wrote about it in the book, but when I wrote it, I had to self-diagnose my own self, and I learned a lot about how it had changed me. You know, combat is bad within itself, but what does it do to the human spirit? And so, and, you know, combat is combat, but we generally think you're fighting a foreign enemy, but a lot of times it's not. It's wherever you are in the situation you're in that could shut you down as a human being. But rather than being shut down, you tend to begin to push on, just like Bob was talking about. And I really appreciate his article. I really do. It's the same feelings, I believe. But, you know, you have to push on. And I told them today, and I said, I know it's metaphoric, and I know you have to understand. And so I went through the process of telling them, but you have to get to a certain point where you have to draw a metaphoric line in the sand and say, I cannot allow my past to determine my future. I have to move on regardless and use your past as a propellant to move you forward. You can't
wow.
honor your friends any better than having a good life, the ones who died.
Wow.
And so you just push yourself on. You know, I tell them that the only difference between me and the people I admire are the choices I make. Bad choices have consequences. Good choices have benefits to them. And if you're ever going to get started having a life, you need to start now when they're 20 years old and 21, 22 years old. They can't wait until they're like my age or your age. We've done what we're going to do. But what we can try to get them to do is understand when we're looking at all these problems in America and with police departments and everybody else, Doug, they bad guys ought to understand there are consequences to your choices. And the more severe the choice is, the more severe the consequences are. And I work with police officers, and I have them to call me in the middle of the night and saying, can you talk to one of these officers? They're having a real breakdown. And,
wow.
And so they're being overwhelmed some of these times. And so when a department is doing really great, they have a pretty good system. I mean, they're working with the bad guys or trying to shut them down. But when you have internal problems in a police department because you have people, It really tears down the entire fiber of the good guys. And so that's what I'm trying to work with. I'm trying to work, trying to get them together so they can fight a common enemy. And it's a difficult thing, but it is very possible.
I mean, Bob, you talk about peace and justice. I mean, it's been a theme of everything that you've worked on for since I met you.
Yes, right.
Sometimes we agree, sometimes we disagree. I mean, we're looking within our own country. We got all social divisions and everything. I mean, incredible demonstrations and everything in the Chicago area where you're on.
Right,
as a consequence of what has happened up there. There's no doubt that the events that transpired up there are horrific, and nobody, when everyone lived through it, you want no family to ever live through it. But then again, we come back and look at the consequences that led up to the event. And
right.
I think one thing that, again, you learned this, again, where you and I both learned this firsthand from the best of the best instructors, in the instance that's raised everything up where the guy had a knife, he was within just a few feet of the other guy, you know, moving or lunging and everything, as you know. And, you know, within that 2 or 3 seconds, it can be on him, and then you're done for.
Right.
So now the police officer has to make a decision. What does he do? And that decision has to be done in a split second, maybe 1 or 2 seconds total for an assessment, evaluation,
right,
and a decision to act. And then afterwards, the stuff is discussed and debated ad nauseum, day in and day out, when the whole event took place from the beginning to end in less than maybe 2 or 3 minutes.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, this is what, you know, when you walk around armed, this is the situation that you live in.
Right.
Quite frankly, I mean, and, you know, to you know, maybe play devil's advocate a little with what you just said, I am very much in favor of disarming the police. Now, when I say this, I don't mean instantly and boom, all guns gone. But I mean, let us at least entertain the concept of what it would mean to keep order in an unarmed fashion versus keeping order in an armed fashion.
Right.
I truly, truly want this dialogue to take place across the country. And, you know, and there are a few police departments in the world where officers are disarmed, including England. And when it came, you know, when the issue of possibly arming the police, I mean, sometimes some of the police are armed, but mostly they're not. The outcry against arming the police came from the bobbies themselves, who realized how much more danger they would be in if they were armed. I recently wrote a column, well, a couple of months ago, about this group called Nonviolent Peace Force that sends peacekeepers to trouble spots around the world. It's one of these, you know, really wonderful organizations that is trying to spread peace. There was an incident in, I think it may have been Somalia, but I'm not quite sure of the country, where rebels took over this village where there were two of the Nonviolent Peace Force guys were there, representing, you know, international peace, you know, peacekeeping organization. They protected about 9 or 10 women and children in this hut that they were holed up at, where the rebels had gone around and were killing the villagers. Had they been armed, they all would have died. Because they were unarmed and stood for something without arms, without armament, without weapons, they stood for communicating with all parties. They had built up respect among all of the groups that were fighting, and were able to talk the rebels out of, you know, taking the women and children and executing them, and they themselves stayed alive, and they wound up saving, you know, about a dozen lives. It was a very powerful story. So the prevailing and simple-minded belief in this country is that you have to be armed to be empowered. You have to be armed to stay safe. And I say that's absolutely not the case. There is a great case to be made that being unarmed but being knowledgeable and intelligent and aware is much more effective at keeping you safe in many ways than being armed, which intensifies the danger that you're in. So, you know, and I'm not trying to say this like simplistically, like, oh, boom, you solve the problem and you walk around with love and you sing Kumbaya and everybody's safe. That's what the cynics say. In the column that you just read, I was trying to at least open the door to the complexity of how, you know, of what security really amounts to. Security at the deepest level of the human soul, and it involves not dehumanizing anyone.
Well, one thing that we've had to do throughout history, and again, this is because of the economics and perspectives of war, we have to dehumanize the enemy, whether they be the enemy here in our own community or the enemy overseas. So, I mean,
right. That's
the first thing you do. But then on the other hand, and again, I brought Ray on because Ray is a survivor of the Ridge, which is one of the worst nightmares in, you know, Vietnam history.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Your company was wiped out and just a handful of still lived.
Yeah.
You know, so here we're looking at the same thing. In if we could come together and everything and the ideals, and again, with Christmas and peace and justice and love and hope and dreams, I mean, that's on everybody's mind and everybody's hope. But then we come down to the hardcore reality. For example, down here in Champaign-Urbana last week, 5:30 in the afternoon, they had two couples in an argument, girlfriend, boyfriend, or old girlfriend and boyfriend got in an argument in the Steak and Shake, and they ended up with a full-blown shootout
at
5:30 in the afternoon on North Prospect at Steak and Shake. I mean, this is inexcusable whatsoever by any stretch of the imagination. And this was two individuals that knew each other that had whatever they had, their just total disagreements that led into a nightmare.
Yeah.
We were seeing that over and over and over again. So the concept and the idea, I mean, what you're espousing, I totally agree with it as a hope and an aim of where we're going.
Yes.
But where is the reality? I mean, Ray, I want to come in here and in your experience, you know, with the Ridge and everything else, I mean, you didn't know the North Vietnamese troops. They didn't know you. You have nothing against them or anything.
Right.
But this was, God, one of the worst horrific defeats for the U.S. Marine Corps in history.
Right. You know, Doug, I hear everything you're both saying, and I agree with most of it. But I do know we're living in a violent world. I know we live in a country where everybody seems to be armed and deadly. And this time of year, you have a lot of drinking. We've talked about that a lot, where you have drugs and pharmaceutical drugs and you're mixing alcohol. And when you have that combination of things, somebody's going to get out of hand. Somebody's going to get jealous. Somebody's going to get hurt. Somebody's going to get shot. And then when the law enforcement shows up, they have to show up in force with everybody they can muster to come to that situation, because they feel like the more power they have, even weapons-wise. I remember when Rodney King was arrested that night. They said a week before that, the LAPD used cast nets. There was at least a shift officer or someone of the staff that carried a net in their car, like a cast net, like a 6-foot diameter net. And what they would do, they throw it on an individual and let him fight his own self. And then you'd walk over here and cuff him up and take the net off. Well, they took him away from him because they said it was inhumane. It was like treating people like animals. But had they had those nets that night, Rodney King probably wouldn't have had the situation that he had and all the things that happened from that. If you did arm the officers with more non-lethal things they could use, I don't know if they have this or not, but I've thought many times that if they had a shotgun, more or less, that would shoot either bean bags, you know, 50 yards. They do have those. But why not have a taser? You could do that. You could shoot somebody 30 and 40 steps or yards or whatever it is, and you could take them down. A lot of people have a gun or a knife in their hand. They're not really threatening anybody with it. You're just saying, I'm like a rattlesnake. You come close to me, I'm going to bite you. And they're out there running their mouths, and they're drunk or they're drugged up, and they are armed. Why not just take them down? You don't have to shoot them. And that would take a lot of heat off the officers, too. But there are logical things they could do. But the officers feel like every time they go on shift, they're taking their lives into their own hands.
Well, they really are, because all of us have lost friends that have been responded to a domestic incident and it turned sour.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the chicken or the egg again. Some people would say, well, the officers generate it. What I would say, the officers are just response. It's sort of like the FBI agent that taught you and I the concealed carry. I mean, here's a legendary FBI agent. He said, cops ain't nothing but historians with guns.
Yeah.
And that's a fact. They respond after the event. And the military is the same thing. I mean, the military, we respond after the event that triggered the whole situation.
Well, unless we're starting the war, and then we respond and create the event.
Which we've done too often here.
Yeah.
The difference is in the law enforcement and the military is the law enforcement go in to apprehend. The military goes in to kill them, neutralize.
Right.
And that is a luxury. It really is. When you have to arrest the same guy 15 times, you know each other. And that's what they did up in Baltimore. They had arrested that guy like 15, 18 times for drugs. And so it was a joke. And they threw him in the back of that truck, and it was a joke. Well, give him a rough ride. Let's teach him a lesson. They weren't trying to kill the guy. And that happens so many times when an officer has to be constantly faced with the same people doing the same crimes or something in the same neighborhood, is they get tired of this stuff. These are normal people. The cop, he has emotions, he has feelings, and it's just by the time he gets his paperwork done, the bad guy's already out of jail and back on the streets.
Yeah.
The same thing over and over and over. And my answer would be, look, if you don't want to go to jail, if you don't want to go get shot, leave people alone. You know, that's
well, I agree with you totally on that, Ray. I mean, I would never say that this is a simple situation or that the police have a simple job. I honor so much, the danger and the utter professionalism that's required to be a police officer. And I fear what I fear the most is the increasing militarization of the police, where the police walks into a neighborhood like the occupying army. And in poor neighborhoods, in black or Hispanic neighborhoods here in Chicago, there is so much of that just creates instant hostility all the time. If that could be if that could be de-escalated by a large amount, there would be a lot more sense of safety on both sides, I think. And now this is not a simple solution. It's a very complex long-term solution, but I hope we can go that way rather than go the other way, where the Pentagon ships military equipment to every police department, and creates, an us versus them. I mean, police should not be in an us versus them relationship to the community that they serve.
The
and
police
I hear
have been,
that a great deal.
One of the things that scares me, I mean, I understand, because it came about from the 3rd U.S. Army Capture Equipment Project, as you both know I was involved in, and then we started rearming everybody, and we came back from all these wars and all this equipment. So the police that are being hired now were involved in the military. They were trained in the military, or some of them were.
Yeah.
And so they said, let's get this equipment. I mean, we had an incident down here where we had another, two home invasions, a standoff and everything else. I mean, totally evil guy. I mean, there ain't no way. He stole a car, hijacked a car, two home invasions, went into another house, and they finally cornered him. You know, and they stood off everything they could. But it was so funny, the response. There was a guy sitting there in desert camis. There was another guy in woodland, which is for the jungle and everything else, and then another guy and everything else, and they got all stuff hanging on them. They looked like they were going out into the field for a war, where like you were gone, going out there for weeks and months at a time and not coming back in. And the fire station was all of 50 feet away, out of the perimeter in a safe area. But somehow you've got all these people, and this is comes in together. What bothers me, the police are mimicking the military.
Right.
And not understanding, Ray, which you have enumerated the role perfectly. I mean, one is the role to kill, destroy, and everything, and the other one is just to apprehend.
Right.
But now this thing, what frightens me is that things have gotten mixed together because the guys who were in the military came out and said, oh, I had this equipment. Now I want it. Now they get into the police, and the thing we've had around, there's not enough training, education, or information to use the stuff that they have, so we run into a problem. And then, like what we had down there in Missouri, and it's had help, all of a sudden they show up with a tank. You know, they show up with military equipment, and the civilian's going, wait a minute, what did I do here to, you know, have the military respond?
Right.
Because they don't see them as law enforcement at that time. They see them as, you know, a full-blown Army unit.
Right, absolutely.
And where are we going? Right?
Well, they're up against the wall, too, Doug, and they don't know how to react. You know, one of the things, like locally, what they try to do is they get the police officers to get more involved in the neighborhoods. The more an officer walks a little bit through the neighborhoods, meeting people, doing different things, it's like backup, where when they see an officer in trouble, they call for backup. They call the police department. They call 911. They do something. Last night I was driving down the interstate, and I looked over, and just about 100 yards from my car, somebody had a taser, a green taser, that they were shining it toward the trees, toward the cars. So I called 911, and I said, you need to check it out. Well, if more people would be involved in supporting the police, it would help them feel like they weren't on their own. Like it's an army out there on their own fighting another army.
Yeah.
They would have people to support them. And I think that's one thing we can do at Christmas time. Send them a card. Do something. Go by and give them. They probably won't take your cupcakes if they're afraid of you. But somebody might try to poison them. But you could just let them know, man, I'm praying for you. I'm thinking about you guys. And what it does, it builds up a little bit of maybe smooth some of the wrinkles out, maybe, and let them know not everybody's your enemy. I saw I was in a training thing not long ago, and I saw a poster. It was about police officers, and it said, "Be professional, be kind, be courteous, and be ready to kill anybody at any minute." I thought, man, that's pretty graphic. Yeah, that's pretty hard.
Yeah,
but
I understand
real.
The concept because you know when they walk up to your car. They put their hand on the trunk and they push it down just to make sure the trunk is not going to fly up and somebody's going to jump out. The other reason is they put their fingerprints on the trunk. And whenever there's a shooting or something like that, they always find the car. The first place they go to check it is that trunk. And they find that police officer's hand on that trunk, on those fingerprints, then they've got some evidence. And so it's always proactive. You have to be proactive in what you're doing. And it makes a difficult situation because you feel like your enemy could show up at any second, and I don't know really how we're going to fix this thing, really, but one bite at a time, I suppose.
Well, Ray, I think you raise some good points there, and one of them going back to your idea of people sending their police a Christmas card or, you know, reaching out to the police, the point I'm hearing you make there is that security isn't just something that's up to the police to take care of. Everybody has to be involved in it. Everybody has to take that responsibility, whether it's reaching out to the police or reaching out in other ways to different types of people and different groups of people. Security is everyone's responsibility. And I would love to see that become a, you know, a paradigm, you know, a shift in consciousness, a shift in social consciousness. That's very important. Now, another thing that has not been brought up yet that does need to be, you know, brought up when we talk about the relationship between the police and the public is the racial factor, the racial issue. There is something, you know, and this is not a police issue, this is a social issue, but this country has had a huge and horrible history of racism and racial discrimination and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And when there is power here on, you know, and police have power, bad guys, criminals have power, you know, this is a war thing, but how do you get beyond the national history of race relations, racial profiling, all that stuff, that just helps create this us versus them situation that puts the police in danger and puts everybody else in danger. It's a big problem. It's not just the police. There needs to be a whole social shift in awareness.
Well, you know, everybody profiles, Bob. I mean, all of us do it. And you go into Walmart, and if your pants are hanging down to your butt and you've got dreadlocks, I don't care what color skin you have, you fall into a certain category where they're going to watch you closer than they would the average person because they're constantly profiling people. They profile because of the amount of people who are doing crimes, whether they're white or black. I did something. I helped a guy in Lowe's not long ago. He was trying to struggle with getting his box or something. It was a black guy about my age.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went over there and I grabbed the box and I helped him get it down. And he said something about, he said, well, I wish there were more people like you, white people or something. And I said, you know what, if you shaved all of our skin, we'd all be pink anyway.
Yeah.
You know, it's only skin deep. That's what it is.
Yeah, it's only skin deep.
We tend to value people by their colors or by their whatever nationalities.
Well, it's just, we look for ways to create differences. And skin color is easily one of them. Language and, you know, that sort of thing is another. But I'm a big fan of getting rid of race at all. I don't identify. I grew up as a white guy. Okay. I don't identify as any race except human. You know, and I say this, it's not easy. I mean, of course I've got this white skin, this white privilege, this white, you know, kind of protection thing going. But I really am in the process of making a conscious effort not to think of myself as white, but to think of myself as human. And that helps me see somebody else of a different,
race. You humble yourself.
As human.
Let me tell you something. I was a little bit hesitant to tell Doug this because Doug and I talk a lot, and he's very kind to me. And I think Doug is a very rational man. And I was in Walmart about a week ago, and I was buying something. I turned around. This Muslim girl was standing there with all of her, I can't think of what they call it, the black outfit, you know.
The burqa kind of thing.
And she was standing there and had this beautiful face. But I felt my blood leave my face. I felt a rush of hate. I don't like hate. I try to put that down. The good Lord has helped me to get rid of a lot of that stuff. But I started to walk away, and I felt that little bit of hate just by her being Muslim. She had a little boy with her. And I walked away, and I thought to myself, what happens if somebody walks up right now and climbs in her face and starts screaming at her about ISIS and everything? Would I defend her, or would I walk away and pretend I didn't see it? Well, I stood there thinking, and I've heard things say before where when a man sees something bad happen and he turns around and pretends he don't see it, he ceases to be a man. And so I stood there, and this little boy walked up beside me, and I looked, and the lady had walked right up beside me, about, you know, a foot away. And before I even realized it, I turned toward her, and I said, how you doing? And she said, she kind of startled her, and she looked at me, and she said, I'm good. How are you? I said, I'm good, too. And I stood there for a second, and then I started to walk away, and I said, look, I hope you have a Merry Christmas, too, like everybody. She said, just startled her again, and she looked at me, and she said, you too. I hope you do, too. When I walked away, I felt a little bit of peace about it. At least I didn't say the wrong thing.
Right. I think that's a really nice story, and I really appreciate I appreciate your telling that. It's standing there and letting the quick, impulsive emotions settle down and reaching for a bigger, deeper, you know, the better angel of your nature, kind of letting that prevail. And, you know, and I think this is what we need to learn how to do. I mean, we live in this world, a society that pretends that there are quick, easy solutions, and it's usually, you know, involves, you know, shooting a gun at something, getting rid of the problem, and then moving on, and there's no consequences. But the story you just told is like there are ways to let our initial response calm down and reach out from a bigger place inside of us, which is what you did. The quote, the guy, you know, the quote that I centered my column around from Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, it's got the key line, the force of love springs from awareness. And I think the story you just told is an example of the force of love you know, you let your this instant, you know, hatred thing kind of that popped up blind, you know, and then you let that pass, and then you reached out with the force of love. And
right.
Anyway, I appreciate your story, and I think that's a little tiny microcosm of how we need to change, you know, and on a daily
too.
Basis.
I've been to war. Doug's been to war. You've been to war.
Yeah.
We know what war is. War is war. And if it comes down to a war, well, I'll fight just as good as the next bulldog.
Uh-huh.
I'm not at war yet, and I haven't identified who the enemy is sometimes. And
right.
So until that happens, I'm not going to be shooting people if I can help it. I might need their help sometime.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
You don't know what you say to change a person's attitude.
Right.
You could make them radicalized if you run your mouth enough, or
yeah,
you could
exactly.
calm them down and be a decent American citizen. So I don't know. It's just
yeah.
no better than the KKKs and a whole other people that get out there and shoot people in the foot, you know, on our language.
Right.
So anyway, I'm sorry. Doug, go ahead.
Yeah, we're coming down to the fundamental of what Christmas is all about. Love thy neighbor. Treat him as you would want to be treated. I mean, that's the fundamental message of this season.
Yeah.
And what I've learned across, yesterday I went in the bookstore. I didn't have a copy, and I went specifically to get some other stuff and buy a copy of the Koran, very specifically because I wanted to read it.
Uh-huh.
And so as I walked up to pay for it, the teller said, well, I'm glad you're getting that. You're going to find out a lot of similarities in everything and what you understood. And it was just kind of like, somebody's actually going to take this and look at it and read it without making a decision or anything, without reading or having the information.
Wow.
And it was just like, boy, this feels really good.
Yeah.
But how do we alter and how do we change individual responsibility? We're seeing, again, at the time, we're seeing over and over again, there's been story after story on the newspaper. These people are getting it, and they go and get it, and they're given to it, and then they want more.
Yeah.
And then they want more, and they want more. Rather than the individual, like what we've all done, and we dedicate our thing to help individuals to get started, to help them get that next leap to where they assume individual responsibility to grow and to do everything. The police have to deal with an incredible recidivism rate. I mean, the prisons are not, I mean, there's no rehabilitation going on in there. By the time an individual gets in there, I mean, when I study corrections for an undergraduate degree in law enforcement, by the time they got in there, they've committed so many crimes that they're hardened. So we're talking 10, 15, 20 crimes.
Yeah.
They've been arrested a zillion times, and they've been convicted a zillion times before they ever get incarcerated. And so when we had this thing, and as I mentioned before, Bob, in response to your column, I went in on was in part of a negotiating team at Fort Madison, Iowa, prison riot. And what I learned and what I saw was incredible, because the guy was very clear, the guy that was leading the uprising said, we're just going to play the game and do whatever we need to do, in other words, to get back out or move on with our life.
Yeah.
And so there was an attitude there that I could see, these are hardened core criminals. There ain't no way to change them. And those do exist in life. And unfortunately, you know, I was raised that your police officer was your best friend, the police chief was your best friend. We need to get back in there where the community policing, where they're one in the same one of the whole group and part and parcel of everything. So then you have individual responsibility. We learn this is what's acceptable, this is what's not acceptable.
Right.
I mean, we're to a point today where you don't leave your car unlocked even when you're going in to, you know, pay for your gas. Well, I can remember it's not that long ago where you didn't even worry about locking your house because nobody was going to go in it where you live because it was just unacceptable.
Yeah,
well, now
when
it has totally culturally changed.
Yeah. Well, you know, self-defense, we talked about it a couple of weeks, Doug, but self-defense is not just arming yourself with a pistol. It is arming yourself with information of how to make your home safer. You put motion detector lights. You cut back bushes around certain areas of the house. I was at a gun range one time, and there was about a million bullet casings laying on the ground. I told my wife, I said, I'm going to get about a 5-gallon bucket of these casings and just put them around the windows of my house. And so the bad guy crawls up there. He'll crawl across all these bullet cases. He's like, I'm out of here, man. I'll go next door. What you have to do is learn how to protect yourself, get neighborhood watch and those type of things. And it comes down to we're not an island by ourselves.
Right.
We have to depend on other people.
Yeah.
And we have to pray that God will keep us a tender heart for the good people and stop the bad people. So,
right. Right. Well, I actually, yeah, I agree with that. And going back to, you know, Doug, you know, talking about the prisons and the hardened criminal thing and all that, yeah, at a certain point, perhaps that is what happens, is that a person becomes a totally hardened criminal. I don't know. But we have to acknowledge that the system helps create the problem. The system is not innocently just dealing with a problem that's out there. The system is taking a role in creating it. So going back to the idea of prisons and the justice system, I'll bring up one of my favorite topics, Doug, which is, as you know, restorative justice. Restorative justice tries to look at harm in a different way. Harm is not solved by punishing someone, by getting the bad guy and punishing him. The concept of restorative justice begins with the indigenous peoples of Canada, Northern Canada, New Zealand, who started to fight back in their own way against what Western justice was doing to their communities. And they started to sit in circles. But as people have pointed out, it's about when a harm is committed, when somebody is robbed or injured or hurt in some way, the first question isn't who did it. The first question is, what is the harm and what will it take to be healed? How do you heal the harm? And if we had a justice system that was focused not on punishment but on healing, we would start to get rid of a lot of the problems created by the creation of hardened criminals, the creation of people that have endured lots of punishment. People can still stay tough guys by going through the justice system and being punished. But if you sit there and you look into the eye of somebody that you have hurt, you are going to start to humanize whether you want to or not. That is the whole, you know, kind of rationale and dynamic behind the concept of restorative justice.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, looking to the eyes, starting to understand and see another person and go, God, this person is a lot like me, starts to change attitudes more than punishment ever will. Anyway, I just throw that into the conversation, yeah. Not to make it sound like this is a simple solution. It's not simple. There's nothing simple about this. And it's not linear.
One time, a pastor went to a woman's house one time. She was the church's person that was putting everybody down all the time. Nobody could do anything right. And he went to see her, and she was talking about her next-door neighbor having... The woman did not wash her clothes right, or the clothes were not washed, you know, sparkly white and clean, and she didn't love her family. And she said, look out the window, and you'll see it. And so she looked out the window, and there was clothes hanging on the line, and they were kind of yellow-looking and dingy. And he said, gracious. But he looked again, and he took his handkerchief and wiped the woman's windows. He said the clothes were sparkling white, and said it wasn't the woman's clothes that was dirty, it was her windows.
Oh, my God, that is a funny story. That is a wonderful metaphor
many times,
right there.
You know, you put on dirty glasses, Bob, you're going to see the world dirty.
Yeah,
get our own
that's
glasses
absolutely
fixed.
Right. Yeah, that, I mean, that's a great metaphor, and that is kind of what we do in lots
of
ways.
Yeah, we allow people always to dirty us up. We listen to them, we hear them, the political thing, and it's like, man, I don't listen to that junk no more. I'm telling you, I got enough problems without people trying to put
hate. Yeah, we look through lenses and we go, look, that's a bad person. No, the lenses are bad.
Yeah, clean your glasses. Ask God to clean your glasses a little bit, and
who knows,
you might find a different world out there sometimes.
Right.
Yeah, we have enemies. We do. But we have to identify. I mean, we have to leave good people alone. We're shooting everybody, and everybody doesn't deserve that. There are some victims. And we're all victims in something. But, you know, we have to distinguish it, and good people ought to stand up more. So,
well, good people ought to stand up more, and I think a lot of more people should say to themselves, I am a good person. And, you know, and I think that's part of it, too. If somebody's been told all his life that he is not a good person, he'll start acting that way.
Yeah.
The thing comes in, though, is individual responsibility.
Right.
I mean, we can have a communication or discussion between the three of us or everybody else, and hopefully this goes on beyond to help other people. And I know, Bob, your columns keep trying to do that.
I hope so.
But But there is an individual responsibility. And the individuals, what we're seeing throughout, and again, it was on the highlighted on the news again today, and they were talking about the educational problems and everything. I continue. I mean, we went to all the computer stuff, and it didn't improve education. It's actually the quality of education is degraded, and they just did the new standardized testing, and it came out with an abysmal failure. And this is individual responsibilities that have come down to it. I mean, as a teacher and educator, and I've been across all these things, I totally firmly believe everybody can excel, everybody can achieve. They have to make the conscious choice to make the effort, and they have the conscious choice to ask for help, accept the help, implement the help that's given, and then grow and do it and move on to the next one. And what we're seeing too often, and this is the horrific part, I think it's a consequence of the social culture. It's very, integrated and intertwined, I'm not sure, where we're seeing too many have made the conscious decision, I'm just going to take, and I'm going to take more, and rather than assume responsibility for myself and grow and expand, it goes the other direction.
Well,
so there
I'm a firm believer
that there is evil out there, and yeah, we have to use all the things to overcome it. But
I think there's evil, but I wouldn't say it's out there. There's evil inside. We all have good, and we all have evil inside of us.
Yeah,
and it's too easy to look out there. Well,
but you make a choice to do it
today. I'm sorry, Doug, but I told those Marines something today, and I told them about hang-ups. And I said, a guy went to a circus one time, and he's looking around, he saw this big elephant stand there, he got looking at him, powerful, big, 8 tons, you know, but he was staked to the ground by a small chain, like a dog chain. And so he questioned that, and he talked to the trainer, and he said, why in the world would you people use such a small chain to hold such a large animal? And the trainer said, we put that chain on him when he was a baby, and as a baby he pulled and tugged and couldn't break it, so he finally gave up on it. Today he could break it, but he don't know it.
Right.
And that's a lot of people. We've been tagged, chained, bound, held back in so many stupid little things that we've been taught our whole life.
Absolutely.
And God said, let go and just love people, man. If it comes to war, we'll do war. I know how to do war. We'll do that. But until I get the call, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to try to break some of these chains that have been holding me back and making me this bad person. Who knows?
Yeah,
it might be a good person inside there.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I think
don't
that's
know.
True.
I know a lot of little stories, and there was one that said a great sculptor was doing this beautiful piece of work, and they were lauding him with all these praises, and, wow, you're so wonderful. He said, no, the masterpiece was there the whole time. All I had to do was get the junk away from it.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of deal. And people, you don't know what we got now. I mean, as long as we're fighting each other, infighting and such, we're never going to get together. I'm not out there hollering kumbaya either. So don't let me project that. But Doug and I know each other too. We're both warriors. We've been there. We fought for our lives. We fought for other lives, and we know all about that stuff. And when it comes down to fighting, you know, I got a little bit of a bulldog in me, just like everybody else.
Right.
But I want to make sure I'm shooting the right people. I don't want to be shooting a lot of collateral damage. I think when Doug talked about all this, the things of the Gulf War that have destroyed so many lives, I believe there were a lot of people up in the up-ups of government in places. They believed in collateral damage, and they also believed in acceptable losses. And I think we were part of that acceptable losses.
Yeah.
In order to get a certain thing gained, you have to lose people, and we were part of that. I don't like those terms.
I mean the troops,
I don't like them. What did you say?
We, meaning by we, you mean the troops, the soldiers.
Right. Right,
yes,
right.
Yes,
the military, they were
part
out
of the
there
collateral
the,
damage, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, having, you know, talked extensively to Doug and learned a lot about depleted uranium and all of that stuff kind of thing, you know,
right.
From Doug, that sort of damage, or in Vietnam, all of the whole Agent Orange and all that stuff that rebounded back to, you know, the American troops as well as the quote-unquote enemy and the civilians out there. There's something really, really problematic about waging war that requires, you know, right away you say there's going to be collateral damage.
Right.
And then not bother to think that collateral damage means consequences. That the, you know, anyway, it's
well, it's I was named after Douglas MacArthur, but I've never really appreciated Douglas MacArthur after I heard him talking about acceptable losses.
Okay,
oh, we could
yeah.
we could lose 3,000 soldiers. That's okay. It's acceptable. And I'm thinking, you're talking about me, man.
Yeah, and that's right.
I don't appreciate. I know that's part of being a general and part of being the upper echelon and all this stuff. Doug understands that. He was talking about the uranium and such. They had to lie about and all this other stuff because
right.
they believed that certain percentage of people were collateral damage, and I don't like those terms. I really don't.
Well, it's starting by thinking what matters first is the strategy and the tactics, you know, rather than the humanity. And I think that's problematic, and that's what war is. And I think that's deeply problematic, and I think we've got to start figuring out how to organize ourselves, by that I mean the human race, in a different way, where we don't have organized collateral damage machines, which are called which are armies and defense departments.
Well, America's been at war for a long time with a lot of people. And
yes.
I truly believe, and I don't know how Doug feels about this, we've kind of discussed it, but I feel like part of our economy has been great because of a lot of the war materials that we produced over the years for us and all the other people. We kept jobs, we were making and manufacturing, and we were doing this, and it was because we were all over the world warring everybody.
Yeah.
And now it's kind of come home, you know. And
it's coming home to roost, yes. I believe it's coming home to roost.
You know, and the thing that scares me about this, and I have to come from the warrior point of view and then the police point of view, our emergency response systems, whether in the police, at the fire, or the medical, ain't prepared. They don't have a clue what they're doing, and our military techniques and tactics we're doing is busted, too.
Yeah.
And that scares me. I mean, it really, truly scares me. And then, you know, we had this horrific event out in California here just, a week ago and everything. But at the same time, we bombed and destroyed a hospital. Well, we're out of time. God bless everybody.
Thank you, Bill. I really appreciate
it. I think a good conversation. Remember what this is all about. It's Christmas. Love thy neighbor and take care of each other and love each other. I mean, I love you both.
Absolutely. The force of love springs from awareness, as Thich Nhat Hanh said. Merry Christmas.
Good night.
Christmas. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.